On Sunday, December 25th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents drummer, percussionist, composer, arranger, general artistic director of the ensemble Afrohorn, and lecturer, Francisco Mora Catlett. Join us as we discuss Mora Catlett's career and the return of Afrohorn to the Winter Jazz Festival. That's Sunday, December 25th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is drummer, percussionist, composer, arranger, general artistic director of the ensemble Afrohorn, and lecturer, Francisco Mora Catlett. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl coming up now.
On my clothes, maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar. My bow.
sele kukoro epo mi urama endeme fi aboro epi urabia inwa ongo yukawa endeme fi urama ana yunkeno boko bokere munansa eni mawai yama piki songo amuna yiro kinyongu sueri o nangobia uisoro nantan eko ara uyo gran su bongo naro yapo ache pura y genuina en el reino del silencio brindando ciencia con ciencia y luz. Amaneceres de allí e índigo ropajes, tan azules como el amanecer, esperanza verde, azul reflejo en pupilas de camello. ¿Qué pasó? ¿Qué pasó? Fuerza de arena en sabana amarilla, paso firme, ¿qué pasó? Sudor azul en la piel a la fuerza del calor, azulando la inerte silla. Sabana amarilla de frágiles montañas, terreno agotador, cantera de su historia azul. Nangobia en de mi a papá que le queda nuevo ya, y naya un coro veo rumo a fin pa' el joven yaga, aname yaga, guane, amuran su mañoño temio, acere otani yongo, efo, longo, guana.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Francisco Mora Catlett.
Francisco Mora Catlett, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Thank you so very much for inviting me, WBAI-FM 99.5. Thank you so much. Glad to be on your program.
I also want to acknowledge, by the time we're talking, you will have already presented, is it Siete Mares?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Siete Mares. That's my wife, Dani Perez, premiere of her new spectacular work on a tribute to the Orisha Yemaya.
Yes, that was so beautiful. Is there going to be an opportunity for people to see that again?
Well, I hope so, because it's a major work. But like everything else, this kind of work requires a lot of budget and a lot of work behind. And really, she pulled it really out of very limited resources. With the support of people, with the support of institutions, mm-hmm. with the support of corporations or somebody out there, definitely it's a go. It's a tour and a spectacle. Definitely, it's a major work. It takes a lot of people. Also Rivers, you know what I'm saying, with the Harlem Business Association supported as well. There's a lot of people involved.
Could you tell the audience about the production? It was a collaborative between artists from Cuba and artists from here, yes?
Yeah, and recapping on the history behind this, it's a company by the name of Oyu Oro, which means Crown of Yemaya. Oyu Oro first performances outside of Cuba were at the Montreal Jazz Festival, where we joined in with a jazz techno thing as the major act for that particular festival. That was 1999. When La Mora moved to New York, at the insistence of her students, she gathered the company again in New York City. And the first major production was Palenque at La Mama, an experimental theater that was downtown on the Lower East Side, Ellen Stewart's place at that time, who was very supportive. And with a grant also and major collaboration from artist Elizabeth Catlett, we were able to bring in Cubans who were scattered around, gathered them in New York City for a big performance about runaway slaves in Cuba. Of course, with the music and the dance and the history, her work is very authentic, you know, Afro-Cuban folklore. So that is the major opening, and that was like 7-8 years ago. So every year she managed to produce something new. So she takes care of completely all of the costume. She does all of the choreography. She induces all of the drumming.
Wow.
And all of the songs, because, you know, drumming corresponds to the dancing, and certain steps are basically with the drum. So there are different rhythms for different songs and for different dances, because she feels that the message always has to be clear. So part of the custom, everything is part of the language. So we've been working also with CTMB, the Center for Traditional Music and Dance, who has sent Oyu Oro on tour towards the United States. So Oyu Oro has been able to travel nationally and perform nationally. Last year when we were in Cuba, because she takes a group of people, she's been doing this for at least 5 years, who are interested in music, dance, and song. from the Afro-Cuban culture. These tours will be starting in Havana, and they will end up in Santiago de Cuba. So you cross the entire island learning about Afro-Cuban culture, which is very extremely diverse in Cuba. And you hear the Havana, you hear Matanzas, all the way to Santiago de Cuba, sometimes all the way to Baracoa. Baracoa was the first capital in Cuba, and there's an incredible presence of folklore in Baracoa. That is at the end of the line, and it's very extremely inaccessible. We were in Cuba last year, and we found out that she had a pain on her left breast. So we went to the doctor, and the medical says, you know, she has a tumor. So I said, well, when this should be taken care of? He says, well, about, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we should have operated on this. Well, let's do it immediately. Because by the time we get to New York City and we go to the red tape and the insurance and the this and the that and the exams and the blah, 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 it's going to be a month. So she took care of that, all of her treatment, you know, because it's wonderful. You know, they put five doctors immediately on her, one doctor that visits her at home twice a week, and a nurse that goes every day.
Wow.
And a family of 30 people. So the support was incredibly powerful with everything that is going on. She doesn't let any grass under her feet. So she renewed the Oyuoro in Cuba while she was there. She started rehearsing and she started doing a new work. And by the time that she came back to New York in February, she was completely cured from cancer.
Wonderful.
And with a small grant, she went about the idea of merging both companies. So we took the company from New York to Cuba. We rehearsed in Santiago for 15 days. A new work is called the Iyawo, and we went to Havana to the Teatro Mella in July and performed there with both companies in one company. So now, you know, with this new grant that she got, she brought the Cuban company to New York. But, you know, it's expensive, mm-hmm. You know, just on transportation, each Cuban is $1,000.
You know,
round trip tickets from Cuba to Miami and then Miami to New York. Originally, we had 12 people invited from the company in Cuba, and we only were granted 10 visas. The Department of Treasury determined that two were possible defectors.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were not granted their visas, you know. As soon as they got in town in November, we started rehearsals with both companies. She is very thorough in rehearsals. Rehearsals are 5-6 days a week.
Wow.
For the Cuban people, you know, during the morning and the evening, joined with the American company. Because the members of the American company, mostly of them have day jobs.
Right.
They can only rehearse in the evenings, you know.
Right.
We were able to work with the Cuban company for a diverse group of peoples and presenters in the area. So we did something for Restoration out there with Ronnie, with his company Evidence, you know, Ronnie Brown.
Oh, yeah, Ron K. Brown, yes.
Yeah. And then Restoration had us perform at Long Island University. And then we performed at the Harlem School of the Arts also. Did workshops, you know, all over the city, and we went to Connecticut as well. And, of course, none of these performances are the same. They're all different.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, that's very unique about her. She doesn't present the same thing twice. So they're all unique. So by the time we got around the last performance and she buckled down on Siete Mares, the work was already on its way, very extensive. You know, I feel that Siete Mares is such an incredible piece of La Mora, so spectacular, so well elaborated. The message is so clear, so authentic. And it comes from the experience of Afro-Cuban people in what they call artistic projection, which is taking the folklore and the things that don't come out of the secret ceremonial work and are more into the popular, portray those ones into the stage with the rules of theater and share with an audience. Fortunately, we were able to videotape it as well.
So oh, good.
We
yes.
hope that it will be available for a general audience. This particular piece is very special. And it doesn't even happen in Cuba.
Mm.
Yeah, this is outstanding. Definitely there's nothing like that in New York City.
Right.
And there's nothing like that in this whole one country. And productions on this length and this particular tradition don't happen in Cuba either.
Wow.
I mean, you have institutions like the Folklorico Nacional who have set repertoire. But
yes.
a work of a magnitude like this is very exceptional. It's very unique. And I feel for the people that were not there, you know,
yeah.
To see it live, because that's part of the experience.
Definitely.
It's so related, my wife's work with my work, what I learned from her. I don't know if she learns anything from me, but I learn a lot. I mean, I claim a couple of ideas. she's just stole it from me. But, you know, but we work together.
Sure.
You know, and things like this. And when I see something like this coming, mm-hmm. I just drop everything and go behind her.
Yeah.
All the way through until it manifests. And then I'm going like, wow. I said, Dennis, you're a genius.
Well, I'm actually spending more time talking about this than I had planned to. But this was an amazing piece, and I'm just grateful that I was able to be there for it. Now, I'm going mm-hmm. to have to wind the clock back to your beginnings. You were born in Mexico?
No. I'm a jazz musician, you know.
Yes.
And I like to feel that I'm in the avant-garde. And I lead a group, you know, a band called the Afro Horn,
okay.
which is inspired in the writings of Henry Dumas. Now,
yes.
I was born in Washington, D.C. My mother is African-American, the artist, sculptress Elizabeth Catlett.
Yes.
And my father is a Mexican painter, muralist Francisco Mora.
Yes.
That's why I grew up in Mexico City.
Okay.
But knowing my mother's culture and starting to play drums since very early age, quite successful in Mexico City, it was always something about coming to the United States, finding out why African-American culture is so powerful. That totally intrigued me. And being a musician, of course, and African-American music, as powerful as it is, just drove me into going to the United States to figure it out. My turning point was when somebody sent me a record from the States of Max Roach called Percussion Bittersweet.
Yes.
And I decided that if I was going to be a drummer for the rest of my life, I want to be like this man. Completely progressive, single-minded composer, plays drums, arrange, you know, he's outspoken. So I work like what you called a sort of a master's degree in music, a 4-year program in 2 years. I was in such a rush to move on. People thought I was a genius, and I got a scholarship from the Mexican government to study at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And that's how I entered the United States in the 70s. Now, the major piece of what happened, after I left Berklee and went back to Mexico, because I felt in debt with the Mexican government, and I wanted to go to Mexico and start an avant-garde jazz program in Mexico City. Because by this time, I had already experienced working with Olatunji,
right.
who opened up the doors for me to the African diaspora. I got exposed to people like Rahsaan Roland Kirk, you know, Miles Davis, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, Mingus, you know, I mean, this is folks that I was seeing every week. I mean, I never experienced in my life, you know, and having the fortune of playing with some of them. I wanted to do something like that in Mexico City, but it didn't work out. So I guess my lucky charm was that Sun Ra came to Mexico City.
Yes.
and he brought me back.
Uh-huh. So how was it when you met him?
You know,
how was that exchange?
Well, it was 73. I knew that I wasn't going to be doing too much in Mexico with this avant-garde jazz thing. I was having a lot of problems. I ended up playing commercial music in order to pay my rent and so, and I was getting really sick of that when I saw in the Paseo de la Reforma poster that says Sun Ra, the Palace of Fine Arts. So I ran out there to see the concert, and I overheard, well, you know, of course I went backstage, John Gilmour and Pat Patrick and Marshall Allen and June Tyson and all of these great people were there. And Sonny is sitting over there talking about the ancient Egypt and the pyramids and the this and the that. And he mentioned that Lex Humphries was going back to Philadelphia because he had something to do, some school work or something, you know, some exams, I don't know. But they needed to bring another drummer. So I said, you know, Sun Ra, I play drums, but you don't need to bring anybody. And I studied with Alan Dawson in Boston and da-da-da, and I played with so-and-so and so-and-so. So he said, bring your drums and audition. So I took my drums there the next day. It was the first one in the theater.
Wow.
And Sun Ra comes and says, play. I said, play what? He says, just play. So I started playing my straight ahead thing, you know, my out stuff, my space stuff, you know. And he looked at me and went away and then come back and looked at me for a little minute, went away and then come back. And I was really putting a sweat. About 40 minutes out there playing like that. And he came out and he says, you got the gig.
Oh, wow.
And that's how I started working with Sun Ra. Sun Ra, to me, it was the most, at that time, and still is, the most overwhelming experience as a musician. Because he encompassed the entire idea of black music in the United States, of black music in the world, and what was it to do that. And the history makeup, you know, like being part of that. Because he had played with Fletcher Henderson. So he was directly coming in from that history background. And I enjoyed so much playing the Fletcher Henderson book and the Sun Ra Orchestra. And then everything else that came over in the criteria of composition and arrangement and the sound and so many other things that were going on. I was very privileged to be working with him and playing with John Gilmour. That's like playing with John Coltrane, something like that, you know? And one day, roaming around in the house, I found this book of Henry Dumas, and I started reading on it, May the Circle Be Unbroken, where Henry Dumas was talking about the Afro horn. And when I read the story, I said, I have to have me an Afro horn band. I didn't know at this time that Henry Dumas was very close to Sun Ra. Here in New York, when Sun Ra was in New York, he was coming back from a Sun Ra rehearsal and got shot here in Harlem by a white cop, you know what I'm saying, when he was like really in his 30s. Toni Morrison says, you know what I'm saying, oh, he's such a prolific writer, an incredible writer. And to me, I mean, this was like first exposure, you know, to Henry Dumas' work. But I took it at heart, and it took quite a while after I left the Sun Ra Orchestra in Detroit in 1980. It took almost 2 years after I decided that I had to put the Afro horn band together. And the Afro horn experience is something of its own, because when we play the Afro horn out there, things happen.
What do you mean?
Well, you get this vibe of being like in a sanctified church or something like that. People start jumping around and the spirit comes down and that kind of thing, you know. It's got that kind of vibe.
Nice.
You know, Henry Dumas says, and may the circle be unbroken. He says, there are only three Afro horns in the world.
Wow.
Nobody knows what they were made of. Who forged it? Musicologists think that they were the Egyptians. They were made from rare metal that comes from Latin America and Africa. And he says that one is in a museum in Europe, one is in Mexico, guarded by a tribe of Indians, you know, indigenous people on the Pacific coast of Mexico. And the other one, a musician by the name of Probe, founded in Harlem.
Oh, wow.
A peddler had walked thousands of miles just to find it to give it to his son, but he gave it to Probe, and Probe was playing in a jazz club. You know, and the story goes on and on and on. You have to read this story. It's,
wow.
It's beautiful. So I was so inspired. You know, we have to work with the myth, like Sun Ra used to say. This is myth. It's mystical. You know, it's magical. It has the ability to lift people's. Henry Dumas says, at the age of the spiral. That's the name of the new CD, by the way. Those are the first words of May the Circle Be Unbroken. He says, at the age of the spiral of musicians, Probe sat cross-legged on a blue cloth, his soprano sax resting against his inner knee, his Afro horn linking his ankle like a bridge. the Afro horn was the newest axe to cut the dead wood of the world. Mm. I'm going like, whoa.
Wow.
I gotta have an Afro horn band and cut some of this dead wood of the world. Gee. I mean, this is what, it really is what jazz is all about. It's really what jazz, I don't know if it was or if it is or it should be, but this is what I learned from listening to John Coltrane, from listening to Miles, you know. Mm-hmm. It cuts the dead wood of the world. It's honest, it's sincere, it's upfront. I'm leading a conference this day. It's called Jazz is African, because I do attend, you know, this is part of the experiences with my wife and working together closely in these things like Siete Mares. I learned so much, especially about the African presence in this continent. So all of these Haitians that move from Haiti to Cuba and then went to New Orleans, Dahomeyan people, Yoruba people, is part of the heritage of the birth of this music we call jazz. Of course, they were persecuted like crazy and stuff like that.
Right.
You're always going to get some Hollywood movie, you know, with some zombie chasing some blonde girl, you know what I'm saying, who doesn't have any business there anyways, you know what I mean, you know.
True.
And some voodoo black mama sitting over there in the middle of all of this, you know, just trying, you know. And this has been ever since. You
right.
know, this, it's already over 200 years of this kind of situation. But the reality of it is that I found a rhythm in Santiago de Cuba that is a shuffle from Kansas City.
I can believe that. Definitely.
There's no book that clarifies this kind of thing. And you go about it in a living experience. So I apply those concepts to the Afro horn. Yeah, I'm really excited to return to the Winter Jazz Fest. This is the release of the At the Edge of the Spiral. What do you call it? The body release or the release?
The CD release.
Yeah, the CD release.
It's a two-CD set,
At the Edge
set,
of the Spiral.
It's a two-CD set.
It's a two-CD set. And there's wonderful music in there. I was very fortunate to have these great musicians in there. You know, Roman Diaz, of course, from
yes.
Havana.
Percussionist.
Arwan Ortiz on piano from Havana. Sam Newson on soprano saxophone. Bruce Williams, alto saxophone. Alex Harning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Rashaan Carter on bass.
Alex on baritone.
I mean, the lineup.
And Salim Washington.
And Salim Washington
makes
on tenor saxophone.
An appearance.
Yeah, who's living in South Africa now.
Right. He
yeah,
was in
Salim,
your
yeah.
earlier band. He was in earlier incarnations of Afro horn, yes?
Yeah, Afro horn started out back in 82, and it was at that time James Carter, a tenor player, Vincent Bowens, Rodney Whitaker on bass, and myself on drums. That
wow.
was like 82 at Baker's Keyboard Lounge. Okay. And I noticed every time the Afro horn plays, something happens. You know, I got a call from Craig Taborn to do something at the Stone.
The pianist.
You know, and he says, you know, yeah, you want to do the Afro horn? I said, sure, man, you know, we'll do it. And then you mentioned Salim Washington. When we started the set, there was no Salim Washington in the view. So I called his home, and his wife said, he left about an hour ago. This is really weird, you know. So I just told the audience, this is the Afro horn. Things happen. So if you see a tenor player coming to the door wailing on top of everything that is going on, that's part of the Afro horn.
Oh, wow.
So we were doing this rendition of When the Saints Go Marching In, you know, that
mm-hmm.
I call The Saints at Congo Square.
Thank you.
because based on Congo Square, which is the settlement of these people that came in, you know, Congo Square goes back to the early 19th century.
Yes.
And when the saints, you know, in Santeria, we call the Orisha saints,
yes.
Santos.
Yes.
And they're also our ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So I call them the saints at Congo Square, you know, like our ancestors or at Congo Square. And I utilize a rhythm that I learned from Cuba called Palo, which mm-hmm. is from the Congo origin.
Yes.
So we were doing our rendition. Hakim Jami was on bass. Alex Harding was on baritone. Myself on drums. And all of a sudden, lead through the front door. And there is Ali Washington, and the audience was so excited they gave him a standing ovation.
Yay.
All the way to the bandstand.
Oh, that's great.
Oh yeah. This Afro Horn Band has given me some of the most exciting experiences, spiritually and musically work. And with these people, there's something else. We did the DC Jazz Festival at the Cavern, and we had a whole African-American audience in there. For some reason, that's the way it worked out. As soon as the music started out, I don't know, the spirit walked in, everything was electric, you know, things like this. At the end of the set, here comes this lady and tells me, this is what I'm talking about. You know, I'm a sick person. And I'm from Cleveland, and I got to make it all the way to Chicago. And I just didn't know how I was going to do that. But you guys have healed me, and I'm here.
Oh, wow.
To Chicago. And thank you so very much. And this kind of explosion, you know, here comes an elder man raising his hands up in the air talking about, y'all got the energy. Y'all got the energy. I got the energy. Got the energy. You know, things like this, you know, I call a Miri Baraka.
Sure.
You know. And I said, please, Dr. Baraka, you know what's going on? He says, the next time the Afro Horn shows up, salute him. So I hope to have something like this coming up at the Jazz Fest.
In the Zinc Bar.
I'm going to have the super band there.
Okay.
I'm going to have a super band. Yeah, because I'm bringing in for the lineup, you know, of course, I'm going to have over there, Roman is going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Arwan Ortiz on piano.
Mm-hmm.
Rashawn Carter on bass, but I'm going to bring Brad Jones on bass.
Ah,
I'm going to have two basses.
Okay.
And then Ahmed Abdullah on trumpet.
Wow, nice.
You know, Antoine Dry on trumpet too.
Okay.
You know, the excellent Bob Stewart on tuba.
Yay!
Yay!
Oh, wow.
In the front line, Sam Newsom, Bruce, you know.
Bruce Williams.
Bruce Williams.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and J.D. Allen.
Oh, wow.
On tenor saxophone.
Okay.
And Alex Harding on baritone.
Wow.
That's the Afro Horn Super Band.
Wow.
That's the Super Band.
Phew. You know, the Winter Jazz Fest, one of the themes this year is social justice.
My conference always starts that. They brought these folks from Africa chained and stripped them of their culture and brutally imposed a foreign culture on them. And they went about to create the most wonderful music that has the ability to liberate the human spirit. That's the universal appeal of this music. And that's what the music does. That's the function of the music. So when you're talking about liberation, to liberate the human spirit, any group of oppressed people in the planet identifies with this music because it gives them the opportunity to liberate their spirit. It's not just racially oppressed. You know, they could be financially oppressed, sexually oppressed, you know, any kind of oppression, you know, some dictatorships and things like this. That's what this music is so popular all over the planet. At one point, Louis Armstrong was the most popular American in the world, on the planet, because of what he did, what he played. The irony about it is that it was created under such oppressive situation, under right. such calamitous situation, you know, under such stress. So when you're talking about that kind of, the music statement speaks for itself of what it does. This is the way I feel about the music. I know that a lot of people is like technical, a lot of people is virtuosity, a lot of people is a lot of other stuff. And I truly feel that in a lot of instances, this music has become a commodity. Yes. This music doesn't vibe the way it used to vibe or the way it should vibe. You know, this music is comfortable. It doesn't motivate you to think or to move or to act or to evolve or to develop or to arrange, to fix things up. It's gotten into a complacency type of situation. We got to shake that out of the music, I think. So. That's my own personal belief. So my Afro horn is my to cut the dead wood of the world. That really is, you know, at the edge of the spiral.
This year, one of the themes of the festival is social justice. Like Craig Harris is going to present Breathe, his ensemble. It was inspired by Eric Gardner, who his last words, you know, I can't breathe. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Craig Harris. How are you doing, Joyce Jones?
Hey, Craig Harris. I am so glad you've joined Sugar in My Bowl to discuss what you'll be doing at the Winter Jazz Festival.
Yeah, that's beautiful. We're going to be there on January 6th at 7 o'clock at the Tishman Auditorium, part of the New School, on 13th Street and 5th Avenue.
Yeah, that's the New School Tishman Auditorium at 63 5th Avenue. And you're going to be doing Breathe.
Breathe, yes. Breathe was a piece that we did on October 16th. And Breathe, there was a call to artists who were kind of frustrated with the killing of African Americans in this country, with this police violence and what's going on, this non-communication between the community and the police. And so we just got together at Mount Morris Presbyterian, and we had a two-hour concert just to maybe inspire people to just think about what's going on. Pretty much coming from when I heard about Eric Gardner, Can't Breathe, it kind of took me back because, as people know, that Eric Gardner was the situation on Staten Island. But a man said he couldn't breathe while he was being arrested and he died.
Yeah, he was put in a chokehold.
A legal chokehold, which has a long history in the city. You know, I play trombone. I'm a trombonist and I'm a composer. And breathing is the essential part of our music. People just talk about your lips and everything, but it's the importance of breath. Mm-hmm. And then if you practice martial arts, breath is important. If you're an athlete, breath is important. Breath is important in everything. And the worst thing, and then all these people were talking about, I can't breathe. And I was saying, no, you got to breathe. You know, they had the T-shirts, I can't breathe. And I'm telling them, no, you got to breathe. Breathing will get you through everything. If you breathe, it can get you through a lot of things. Proper breath is important.
So how did you wind up bringing this to the Winter Jazz Festival?
They reached out to me because they're very concerned about the situation themselves, and I think they have a whole part of their programming was dealing with social issues this year.
That is true. Well, we look forward to seeing you there. It's going to be at 7 p.m. at the New School Tishman Auditorium, 63 5th Avenue. Is there anything else you want to tell the people about Breathe?
It's a large piece. It was initially, the piece was written for woodwinds and brass only, because that's the breathing instrument. But then just the response was so great from the artist, I added other instruments. So there'd be 50 instruments on stage.
Wow.
And there'd be an image, there'd be video going on. And we're going to make a statement to just inspire people to breathe and just have some form of resolve so we can start dealing with everything that's getting ready to go on in our country and everything prior that's been going on. You have to breathe through bondage. You have to breathe through brutality. You have to breathe through bigotry.
All right, Craig. Well, thank you so much for sharing this with the Sugar in My Bowl audience, and we look forward to seeing you in January at the Winter Jazz Festival.
Right. You sugar, y'all stay sweet.
Please.
All right.
Breathe. And there
well,
are
this
other...
goes right in time because Henry Dumas got shot by a white cop, you know what I'm saying, in the subway. And this was in 1968. And this is 2016 now, and we're still seeing the same shooting all over the place. You know, it hasn't slowed down.
Right.
One of the most brilliant literary minds at that time got shot. You know, and they claim it was a mistaken identity. There was never no clarification behind Henry Dumas' murder. Henry Dumas' children both committed suicide.
Oh, my.
Yeah, with the tragedy of the dad, you know what I'm saying? It's not that I'm just devoted to his writing. There's a CD of Sun Ra and Henry Dumas talking.
Yes.
You know, having a conversation.
Yes.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to right now is the title track from Beyond the Purple Star Zone. Our guest for this evening is Francisco Mora Catlett, drummer, percussionist, composer, arranger, general artistic director of the Afro Horn Ensemble, and lecturer. The Afro Horn Ensemble will be returning to the Winter Jazz Festival on January 7th. What you're listening to right now is the title track from Beyond the Purple Star Zone, Sun Ra and his Omniverse Jet Set Orchestra. That's from a performance at the Detroit Jazz Center in 1980. It was originally released on Saturn Records in 1981. This is from an Art Yard 2006 reissue. Before that, we heard The Spirit of the Blues from Afro Horn at the Edge of the Spiral. The Winter Jazz Festival Return is actually a CD release event for this recording. Francisco Mora Catlett, Afro Horn at the Edge of the Spiral, 2015 AACE Records. Afro Horn, the ensemble, was inspired by Henry Dumas, his writings, and his life. What you heard before that was Saints of Congo Square. That's from Francisco Mora Catlett's 2007 premiere crew release, Outer Zone. Before that, we heard Immortal Being, also from Beyond the Purple Star Zone, from the Detroit Jazz Center 1980 performance. Before that, we heard Olodo from Francisco Mora Catlett, the Afro Horn Rare Metal release. That's a 2013 AACE Records release. Before that, we heard Mandela's Muse from Francisco Mora Catlett, the latest release, Afro Horn at the Edge of the Spiral, which, as mentioned, was released in 2015. Before that, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. That's from The Very Best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is an RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. This recording from an RCA BMG compilation that was released in 1998. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams, and you can hear more about the Winter Jazz Festival during that segment. Many thanks to Hank Williams, who will be providing more information about the Winter Jazz Festival in the new year. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues with Francisco Mora Catlett. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for December 25th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show continues our 2017 Winter Jazz Fest coverage with percussionist Francisco Mora Catlett and a brief visit by trombonist Craig Harris. You can see Harris and his Breathe Ensemble on their first marathon night of music on January 6th at New School's Tishman Auditorium. Catlett leads Afro Horn on the second marathon night at Zinc Bar on the 7th, and later in the month at Clemente Soto Velez Center on the 19th. We recommend getting to Zinc Bar extremely early for the Catlett show. We'll have more details on Winter Jazz Fest at the bottom of the segment, but let's get to our music listings. Pianist Harold Mayburn closes out the year at Smoke with a John Coltrane tribute running through January 1st. Trombonist Steve Turay joins him as a special guest on the 29th and 30th. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at Iridium on the 27th. Dr. Leonard Jeffries has two appearances this week at local Kwanzaa events. You can catch him on the 27th in Harlem at the New Amsterdam Music Society, and in Queens on the 30th at the Jamaica Performing Arts Center. Hammond B3 organ master Dr. Lonnie Smith leads an octet at the Jazz Standard from December 28th through January 1st. Bassist Mimi Jones hosts a jam session in the late set at Smoke on January 2nd. Pianist Harold Mayburn joins Brandy Disterheft's trio at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club on the 4th. Saxophonist Billy Harper leads a quintet at Dizzy's Club on the 4th and at Smoke on the 6th. Poet Jesus Papaleto Melendez reads, and dancer Patricia Nicholson Parker performs in separate sets on the 7th at the Clemente Soto Velez Center, and that's part of Vision Fest promoters Arts for Arts' month-long Justice's Compassion series. Bassist William Parker and drummer Hamid Drake team up for a Roy Campbell tribute on the 9th, and again on the 16th and 18th at Clemente Soto Velez, and that's also part of Arts for Arts' same series. Drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun's gallery exhibit of his visual art collaboration Azza continues at the Bronx Music Heritage Center through February 11th. We mentioned Vision Fest promoters Arts for Arts' Justice's Compassion series, and that series of jazz, poetry, and visual art runs several nights a week from January 2nd through 22nd at Clemente Soto Velez Center on the Lower East Side. We've highlighted a few events, but we'll send you to their website for the full schedule of 65 performances. We wrap this week with the annual Winter Jazz Fest running from the 5th through the 10th. We already mentioned Francisco Mora Catlett and Afrohorn and Craig Harris's Breathe. Other festival highlights include an opening concert by saxophonist Pharoah Sanders on the 5th, a closing performance by the Liberation Music Orchestra, led by pianist Jerry Allen on the 10th as a tribute to the late bassist Charlie Hayden, and two marathon nights filled with music on the 6th and 7th. Drummer Andrew Surreal is artist in residence, and the festival theme this year is social justice. There are way too many former show guests on there to mention, so we'll send you to our blog where you can find a preview and a link to the full schedule, and we'll have our annual Cheat Sheet Festival Guide up after New Year's. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. We'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website for details. This is Hank Williams signing off with our biweekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI in the new year on Sunday, January 8th. Either way you connect, we'll see you in 2017 on the Bandstand.
Listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
The whole goal of humanity is to be destroyed.
Why would you say that?
That's why they end up in the cemetery.
And I was noticing some of the equations that you talk about, equating the life forces with also the death force, like a wish. But in man, there's a death wish. Why is this true?
Well, it's just like the election day came, and that's what he chose. He always, man always got a choice. So they chose that. It wasn't that they were told what would really happen, but they just had a chance, like anything else, like a presidential election. They put two men up there, and you have to choose one of them. So election day came for man, and he chose what he got. He chose his leader. The symbol of a leader, the image of a leader, Buffy. When you're dealing with power forces, you can't really choose a leader. You have to choose images and symbols, so it's too vast.
Mm-hmm. Is that the reason why you are in the sign of the Sun Ra?
Well, everybody have to be what they really are. Mm-hmm. That's what I really am. Somewhere else. Because I don't consider myself as nothing on this plane of existence because there isn't anything here.
You know, Earth?
It just looks like it is, but it's not. It's just like you go to a theater and sit up and you look at a beautiful stage. Mm-hmm. It doesn't stay that way as soon as the next act comes in. Then you got some more scenery. It won't look like the same stage after. Stagehands get to changing it around.
Well, you're saying Earth is a stage.
Yes, a stage.
What's the next act for Planet Earth?
Next act is the finale.
Finale. Will music be a part of this finale?
Well, music is going to be the bridge to. It's just a finale of the traditional things. Mm-hmm. The traditional things got some meaning in them, but comes a time when you need something else. You might say you go out and buy some food and cook it. And you have to have some pepper and salt, too. You have to have some seasoning. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Max Roach, you got an opportunity to study with him. And from what I read, you didn't necessarily study music. You studied the business. Is that true?
Yeah. The thing about it was that, of course, I already told you that initially I was inspired in his work to be somebody like him if I was going to be a drummer for the rest of my life. You know? And part of that is also this social justice that you're talking about on this theme, you know, because Max was doing things like the Freedom Now We Insist, you know, back in the early 50s.
That's right.
And Percussion Bittersweet, which is the album that I was sent, you know, it's got strong pieces, you know, like
Garvey's Ghost.
Yeah, with Abby Lincoln singing in there, you know, and he's got all these people like Eric Dolphy and stuff like that, you know. So so it's quite a piece of music to say, if I want to spend the rest of my life playing drums, I want to be like this. That was set in my mind. So I lived in Detroit for about 20 years. And one of the things that Detroit was good for me is because it used to be a really strong African-American city. It's a black city, you know, and so many musicians came out of there.
Right.
So I was very fortunate to be able to play with a lot of the most outstanding folks like Marcus Belgris and Kenny Cox, you know. And we had a percussion choir with Roy Bruce called the Aboriginal Percussion Choir. And he invited Max Roach to come and play with us at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And I have met Max before at an exhibition of my mother's here at the Studio Museum in Harlem in 1971, 72, because the State Department wouldn't allow her to come in. She was undesirable.
What?
Yeah, she, yeah.
Wait a minute, she was born here.
Yeah, but my mother had to resign her U.S. citizenship in Mexico City because she was almost being deported. That was a traumatic experience for me because the Mexican federal came over and kidnapped her.
Oh, my goodness.
While my father was not in the house, and I was like only about 11 years old, and I had to fight, you know what I'm saying, this federal Mexican agents, you know what I'm saying, who dragged my mother and threw her into a car and disappeared at 11 o'clock at night. And I'm standing right on the street not knowing what's going on. So after a week, my mother appeared, showed up. So what happened? He says, well, I was going to be deported. The McCarthy was running at that time. It was the late 50s, you know, and they were looking for all this outspoken folks all over the planet, you know what I mean, and sending them back over here to whatever, you know what I mean? Some of them got electrocuted, you know, and it was horrible.
So-called communists.
You know, it was, yeah, it was really horrible. So we asked her, I said, how come they didn't deport you? It was because I have three Mexican kids and I'm married to a Mexican man.
Wow.
So we said, wow. So what she did in order to avoid for this ever happening again, she went and resigned from U.S. citizenship.
Wow.
And when my grandmother was very sick, she tried to enter the United States, and the U.S. said, no, you're undesirable. You're not desirable in the United States. It says you renounce your American citizenship. You lost all your rights and privileges. You cannot come into the country. So what happened? My aunt, you know, ended up sending my grandmother to Mexico. It was the best choice because she ended up extending her life for almost 15, 20 years.
Oh,
you know?
Wow. Beautiful.
But that was exactly what was going on. So my mother couldn't come in the United States. It took the National Conference of Artists to make a petition nationwide and present it into Congress for them to give my mother a special 10-day visa cultural permit to come to New York City with an exhibition at the Studio Museum in Harlem, which it used to be on 5th, between 125th and 124. I don't know if you remember on the second floor over there. It was like a house town.
Oh, okay.
And the museum used to be over there. I was in Boston at Berklee College of Music, and when I heard my mother was going to be, I came to New York. Here's the exhibition. She brought a staggering. People were not imagining that kind of. It was so much work. It was incredible.
Wow.
People from all over the country came to see the exhibition. That's how big that was, you know. So Max Roach shows up with Oscar Brown Jr.
Hey.
And I'm standing over there looking at it. I say, wow, Max Roach. This is my first time ever seeing him. You know, I was in Boston studying with Alan Dawson, just trying to do my best, you know. So I go and said, Mr. Roach, you know, Percussion Bittersweet and so, and I'm in Boston. And what can you do in order to be a real good drummer? He says, you practice all day long and you play all night long. Said, okay. And the first time that I practiced all day long, when I got back to Boston, you know, I said, yeah, it's done. Now I got to play all night long.
Wow.
He came to Detroit to work with the Aboriginal Percussion Choir. And I went to him and I said, I would like to study with you. You think if I make an application to the National Dome of the Arts, would you write me a letter? He said, sure, man. So he wrote me a letter of support, and I made a tape. I sent it to the NEA, and they gave me the grant.
Wonderful.
And I came to New York. So I go over to Max's apartment, and I'm sitting over there, and he comes and says, look, Francisco, we're not going to be doing ramadiddles and paradiddles and ratamacus and stuff like that. You know, you're going to learn the business. Mm. And by the way, what are you doing next month? I says, well, I'm here studying with you. He says, you're coming with Umboom to Paris.
Oh.
You're understudy.
Oh, wow.
And I said, whoa. So go to work immediately because an understudy has to learn everybody's part. Not just the individual, you know, same guy, you know, after it's, but everybody's part.
Wow.
So I have, who really put a wing on me in Umboom was Warren Smith.
You know,
I'm always going to be very grateful to Warren, you know, for that. You know, he saw that I was a bit rusty on mallets, so he gave me some exercises to improve, you know, and to get faster on that. When we traveled with Umboom, it was always nice to go hang out with Warren because he was always seeking for something interesting to do or something out of the thing. And, of course, there would be situations where Ray Mantilla was late or is not showing. His seat is empty and all the conga drums are there. And Max turns to that and says, Francisco, get on the congas. And I got to go over there and start playing on the congas, you know, and here comes Ray Mantilla looking at me like I took his gig or some stuff like that. But it became sort of a working relationship and a learning process thing because it's not sitting on a classroom. It's the way that the African culture transcends from one generation to another generation.
Right.
He put his wing on me. He took care of me. When the money of the grant came through and I took the check to him, he said, what is this for? I says, well, this is the money from the NEA. He says, come on, man, you got a family.
Wow.
And he endorsed it and gave me back the check.
Oh, beautiful.
That's the kind of generosity, you know. He taught me how to be like that, so I tried to be like that. He says, you always take care of your man and your band better than you do yourself. So when I'm on tour with my band or with my wife's company, I always apply the same type of ideas. So this is the kind of things that you inherit. That's why I said the jazz is African, you know.
Right.
These are values that transcend even the playing of the music, you know. We get to a place, everybody's walking out like a star, and Max is like, you know, this stage is filthy. So he go over there and grab a boom and start feeding himself. And immediately everybody runs over to do the thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, you lead by example, you know, that kind of thing, you know.
Right.
And the other most precious thing, really, that I got from Max is his certainty of me being who I am. Because I start working with Max in all kinds of capacity, all kinds of situations. So I get over to his house, and he's mad because the Japanese just broke down, you know what I'm saying, all of this. He's worked with Clifford Brown, and we were getting ready to go to the first Clifford Brown Jazz Festival in Wilmington, Delaware. And he was really mad because they had broken up the originals, and they had made, like, the best of Clifford Brown. And Clifford Brown plays ballads, and Clifford Brown this, and Clifford Brown that,
oh,
you know
my.
What I mean? And the original albums, which were conceptual in the order of the tunes and everything, like, they had destroyed all that stuff. So he was really angry about that. And this is the spirit in which we're living, you know what I'm saying, going to Wilmington, Delaware. But when we got over there, we went to the high school where Clifford Brown went. So, you know, I get to hear all the stories, everything. We saw the trumpet and the music and this and that. And we're just walking around, and he's telling me about what happened and the accident and so, and how hurt he was in the time. Very personal, intimate things, you know what I'm saying,
sure.
In the music of what's going on. When we got over to the rehearsal, Harold Land was there. George Moreau was there. Sam Daiquiri was there, all these folks, some of them who had played originally with Clifford Brown and Max. So we're on the bandstand, and the Japanese Sonny record shows up talking about, hi, Max. Can I say dirty words over the phone? Max, get the fuck out of my face. And the guy is like, but Max, his voice, and Max's voice gets, it starts getting higher.
Mm.
And when Max's voice is starting getting higher and he's really angry, you know, he's about to do something, you know
Uh-oh.
What I mean? You know, like, this is like, this folks came out of a racial situation with violence,
right.
With gangsters, with prostitutes, with drug dealers, and heroin, and all this stuff.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You know, they had to defeat in order to make that music, you know.
Right.
They had to overcome all of that stuff and shine at the top of all of that stuff with the music. That's the experience of the music, of this so-called jazz music, is phenomenal. What these musicians had to transcend. And here's a guy from Sonny Records, don't have no idea. you know, and Max is going angrier and angrier and angrier. And the stage manager come out and says, you better get out of the bandstand. So the Sonny guy is gone, right? Everybody's looking at Max like, uh-oh, you know. So he says to me, he says, Francisco, I want you to go over there and check the sound. You know how I want the bass drum right in their face of the hi-hat? I want to hear that hi-hat. Yes, Max. You know, so I go over there, you know, fix the sound, fix the board, make his bass drum real clear, make the hi-hat very snappy. You know, everything is sound good, looking
right,
good.
Right.
So I go back over there, and Max says, okay, Francisco, send on the drum set. I want to hear how this sounds. So now he goes on the audience, and I'm playing my Max Roach thing, you know, really innocent, you know. So I'm keeping it right there. And George Moreau is real happy, you know, walking, you know, smiling at me, you know, and Harold Land is like wonderful. He's looking at me like that, and, you know, and Sam Thackeray is looking at me, winking his eye and stuff like this, you know, and everything is good and like real. And all of a sudden I see Max coming straight to me and comes and says, Francisco, what the fuck are you doing, man? I said, I'm playing the sound check like you told me. He says, man, you're playing my play your own thing. You know, I want to hear some of this San Francisco stuff. So the first thing that boom, 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 the first thing that goes is the bass drum. and the ching, chinky, ching. Now you go, and George Murrow looking at me like, what happened, man? You're going crazy. Harold Land turns around talking about, what's going on? What's going on? What happened? Sam Thackeray looked at me with the most horrified face any musician ever gave me in his life. And Max is standing on top of me talking about, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I want to hear, some of that Francisco stuff. Yeah.
All right.
Wow. I'm so grateful for that type of experience.
So
that's
there's one.
This jazz is Africa.
There's one other thing I need to ask. Roman Diaz. Did you meet him in Yoruba Andabo?
No. Roman Diaz I met through Danis Perez Prados La Mora because he came over and started playing some of La Mora's classes at Alvin Ailey.
Okay.
And then they were acquainted from Cuba. Roman knows my wife since she was 11 years old dancing in Santiago de Cuba.
Oh, wow.
Because Roman used to travel with Yoruba Andabo all over the island. So they were all part of the same artistic folklore family.
I see.
You know, he was working at Harbor Boys, and I was going out there to sit on his bata class. I started talking to him about the idea of bringing back the Afro horn. Arwan Ortiz actually challenged me to it, you know, because he said, let's go record this. And I said, no, man, because every time the Afro horn comes around, stuff happens. He says, what do you mean stuff happens? I said, so we start talking about surrealism, and we start talking about Alejo Carpentier, you know, Afro-Cuban surrealism, you know, and stuff like that. And it all kind of makes sense, you know, from the literary point of view, from the historical perspective, the African presence, you know, it all makes sense. So he challenged me to record it. But I had already talked to Roman about the Afro horn and things like that, and he was interested on it. So once that kind of like came together, and I don't know what I'm talking about, let's go record this. I said, well, you got a good bass player? He says, yeah, Rashan Carter. So I talked to Rashan. He was very interested in the project. This was the first Afro horn CD, and I called it Afro horn MX. MX because I'm dealing with the, you remember I told you it was three Afro horns and one is in Mexico. Well, I grew up in Mexico. It's no coincidence. You know, so I figured out I'm the Afro horn from Mexico. Afro horn MX. But it's also MX for Malcolm X.
Okay.
See? And 125th Street and Lenox Avenue, which is Malcolm X.
Right.
I wrote a tune for that. It's called 125th Street. It's from the first double CD. So we went into the studio, and sure enough, stuff started happening. You know, we recorded a tune, you know, called El Quinto Regimiento during the Civil War in Spain, you know, against Franco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the resistant people used to sing this tune.
Oh.
You know, and John Coltrane recorded it as Olé.
Okay. Wow.
Da 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 da. Da da dee do dee da da da. Da da dee do da 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 da. Da da dee do dee da da da.
Wow.
Yeah, and so a lot of people have recorded that tune. Charlie Hayden would.
The Liberation Music Revolution, Orchestra.
Yeah, he recorded it too. Mm-hmm. You know, so I figured I would do an Afro horn version of this.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I'm going to call it El Quinto Regimiento, which is the original name of the tune.
Okay.
So we were doing that. We faded it. And one says, I think the ancestors are looking at us because I saw something passing by. And I don't know what it was.
Mm.
Well, there you go. The Afro horn is on their house. And
no.
For the horn section, I brought one of the original Afro horn guys, Vincent Bowens from Detroit. I had J.D. Allen. In some kind of a way, I was drinking a cup of coffee outside of the studio, and Alex Harding shows up with his horn. And he was playing with Fela, and Fela was in D.C. He said he heard about the recording, played his matinee, because they were not working on Monday, and we recorded this on a Monday, put his horn in his car and drove from D.C., and there he is. And I said, whoa, okay, well, you know, you're on the set. Come on, let's go, man. Let's put this down.
Nice.
You know, and that was the first Afro horn CD that came out. Once that we set that out, you know what I'm saying, Roman and me start talking about how all this ties in together. Because we're talking about one experience of African people. Of course, some were dropping Cuba, some
mm-hmm.
were dropping the United States.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And we both oppose the idea of being influenced by, you know, like this is Afro-Cuban influence. We don't say that. We say this is the presence.
Mm.
So we agree that because of my experience in the United States, living in Detroit for 20-something years and playing everything from a sanctified church to I don't know what in Detroit, having that collected funk, soul, gospel, swing.
Mm-hmm.
One day it got me in Detroit. I said, all of a sudden the light came on, boom. And I said, now I know why this black music is so powerful. You know why? It's the struggle. That's why it's so powerful. You know, and I said, oh, man. And at that moment, I felt that I could really swing, which I felt contrived. And then I realized. And then after those experiences with Max Roach, you know, and I said, you know, I'm part of this whole thing.
Right.
You know, I'm in the history of this whole thing, you know, and I'm going to suffer and I'm going to enjoy just like everybody else does, because this is part of the whole thing. Having that experience, you know, of African-American with Roman, whose experience is Afro-Cuban, we come and merge. We bring together our experience, and we decided that I don't tell Roman what to play in the Afro horn. He plays, and we start noticing that sometimes a Congo spirit wants to speak.
Sure.
Let him speak.
Sure.
Sometimes Arara spirit wants to speak. Let him talk.
Right.
Sometimes the Yoruba style wants to do something. Well, let him go ahead. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
You know, and I'll keep the other thing, you know. So we do a rendition, for example, in this new CD, which is a clear example of something I'm talking about. At the Edge of the Spiral, we do a rendition of Nobody Knows the Troubles.
Yes.
You know, nobody knows the troubles I see. And I was inspired about it because I saw Max doing it with a set of batas in Cuba.
Oh.
You know, and I said, I'm going to do this in this album. And the tune vibes in what we call a 6/8 on a church time, which is ching, chicky, ching, chucky, ching, nobody knows the troubles I see. But if you bring that 6/8 and you bring the Afro-Cuban, and then Roman starts saying, with the gospel, you know, since 6/8 that they play in churches, you know, the African American.
Uh-huh.
That's the merging thing that I'm talking about. That's
wow.
when it comes together.
Right.
And then Sam played this awesome solo on top of that stuff, you know?
Wow.
I was mixing it in the studio, and some musicians walked in, and they couldn't figure out where one was.
Oh.
Oh. Said, what's the tempo, man?
Oh.
What's going on here? Because they keep hearing the bembe.
Mm-hmm.
The Afro-Cuban bembe working together, you know what I'm saying, with the gospel, 6/8, you know,
right.
and they couldn't figure it out.
Right, right.
You know? I mean, to me, it's such an obvious point of departure.
Sure.
You know, it's like two people coming together, you know what I'm saying, you know, the two brothers that were somewhere, they come together, they notice they're talking the same language.
Right,
you know, and
exactly.
With a different accent, I don't know what, you know, but
it's
it comes
perfect.
Together so solid.
Yeah.
So solid, like it belongs to, and this is what Henry Dumas talks in his book also, you know, when you read Thorn, for example,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you read, you know, some of this Caribbean ideas and stuff like that, you know, then you see how this whole thing comes together. It's one whole experience of African people in this continent. Mm. And one relates to the other one. Mm-hmm. But we never look at it like that. We look like Cuba doesn't have to do nothing with, let's say, with funk from the United States. No. Mm. It's intrinsically related.
Right.
It's related to each other, and it works together.
Right.
Under the most incredible circumstances, folks go about and create something so unique that has the characteristic to liberate the human spirit. You know, that's what it does. It's like what jazz musicians do, you know what I'm saying? We learn from our own experiences, and we take it to a different level. I mean, the way that Sandra was criticized was pitiful.
Right.
It was pitiful. He's crazy. He's a madman. He's gay. He's that.
Goodness.
He's the other one. He's so-and-so, da-da-da-da, so-and-so. The most magnificent musician of the 20th century, mm-hmm. Sandra. Without description. I mean, he's fierce. People dogging him and stuff like, you know, without Sun Ra, I just want to make this point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This turned out to be an incredible experience for me. I was in Detroit, and my older daughter, Ife, with pink hair, coming, running, talking about, techno is the newest thing, Dad, and this is so great, and this is so incredible, and this is so, and I said, honey, you know, electronic music, they're not doing anything new.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean? I says, yeah. I mean, Sandra was playing this stuff back in the early 50s. So she went and told a fellow by the name of Carl Craig, you know, one of the techno superstars from Detroit. So
I was just going to ask you about him. Thank you for going there.
So Carl Craig is like, Mr. Moore, can I have a meeting with you? I said, sure, man. So we're over there sitting tea, listening to Sandra's synthesizer solos, the DJ, you know. And he was blown away. He had never heard anything like that. You know, and I tell him, I says, you know, look, European experience on classical music, you know what I'm saying, it's about trauma, you know, World War II and all the other stuff that they got going on there. You know, electronic music and African-American experience, it's about dance.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's about, you know, this free expression and stuff like this. You know,
right.
This is what it is. You know, look at the, you know, Sandra had already... Robert Moog built him a special synthesizer
mm-hmm.
in 1958.
Right.
He was playing electric piano in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said, you're crazy. Nobody will play jazz on electric piano. And then they say, you're crazy. Nobody will play, you know what I'm saying, jazz on a synthesizer.
Right.
You know? Look at Herbie Hancock.
Exactly.
You know, when he Strauss album and stuff like that. What Miles did with electricity, you know
right.
what I'm saying, his horn and stuff
right.
like that, you know. So all of this is history. So he said, you know, Mr. Moore, can I borrow your album? I said, look, man, I don't let my albums on my books. But you being a young guy, you know what I'm saying, and really trying to learn about this, you know what I'm saying? But I want it back. I still haven't got it back.
Oh, no.
He took my son. Yeah, well, eventually I got a copy of all of the synthesizer solos. Somebody in England, you know what I'm saying, gave me a copy.
This is Carl Craig who took your stuff, right?
Carl Craig.
Oh.
But a week after that, he calls me up talking about, do I want to record an album with him? So I says, well, we need us a good bass player. So he says, do you know somebody? I says, I know the best, Rodney Whitaker. He's got a huge white track. So Rodney and me went over there. We present the credentials and everything. And I have to say, Carl Craig paid us good. I mean, good. This was no $75 a year. You know?
Oh, my gosh.
He paid us good. So we went over there and recorded this stuff, you know what I mean? And we go to the recording studio, and he's got a little breakfast for us and that kind of thing. You
uh-huh.
know? We go in there, and we lay some tracks and so, and da-da-da, and so, you know. And about 3 months later, I'm playing a concert in Detroit, and this guy comes running, talking about, a bug on the basement, man. A bug on the basement. I said, what is a bug on the basement? He says, you are all over.
That's
it's
it.
It's the biggest hit on drum and bass. It's the biggest hit. Da-da-da-da, so-and-so. I said, really? Then I get a call, and it's Carl Craig. He says, do you guys want to go to Japan? I said, yeah, sure, man, you know. So instead of going to Japan, we went to London. And I found out that people in the plane going from Detroit were going to the same festival in London that we were going to play. And they had ambience on one tent, house on another tent.
Mm.
They had one tent specifically for Detroit. And I said, wow, I never knew that Detroit had so much electronic music. And we went around 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, it was just Rodney, Carl Craig, and myself. So the moment we get it ready to take off, there's a short on the stage, like, and all the electricity goes off.
Oh, my goodness.
So all of Carl Craig's electronic stuff is gone.
Oh, no.
So he turns around to me and says, "You got it, Francisco." So I start playing my Sun Ra out stuff.
Nice.
And the crowd that we got over there had just walked out of another thing, and they heard a Carl Craig with the Inner Zone Orchestra, which was two guys, you know, was going to be in the Detroit. So they all came over here. There was 40,000 kids in that thing.
Wow.
And I'm playing this out stuff, and I noticed that the further out that I go, the more they're screaming, the more they're like, and I said, "Wow, they like this out stuff." And I thought to myself, all of this music really is about exposure, because it's what you present to the people and how you present it to the people, that the people react. Detroit Experiment, yeah. I'm on that too. The Detroit Experiment.
Was that after Innerzone?
It's a much more later project. Yeah, it's a much more later project.
Okay.
That included several Detroiter. Fanny Maupin is there.
Yes.
J.D. Allen was there.
Yes.
Regina Carter is there.
Marcus Belgrave.
You know, Marcus Belgrave is there.
Jerry Allen.
Yeah. I'm playing percussion on most of this stuff. That was different from the Innerzone. Because what happened to the Innerzone, after we finish playing this concert and we go backstage, the guys come and says, "Who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm Francisco Mora Campbell. How you doing?" I said, "Well, who have you played with, man?" I said, "Sun Ra." And they said, "Sun Ra? Wicked, man. You play with Sun Ra?" And I'm going, like, these are young guys. You know, I'm going, like, "You guys know about Sun Ra?" And they say, "It's part of being educated." With the Innerzone Orchestra is that when Rodney left, because he was doing a lot of jazz gigs, you know what I'm saying, and then he went into the, you know, with Wynton at the
Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and stuff like that. He got really busy. So Craig Tabor came in the Innerzone Orchestra.
Pianist.
Yeah, the pianist. But he's such a whiz on electronics as well. That whole thing went incredible. Carl Craig has brought us in for a couple of reunions, but not with Craig Tabor. A keyboard player from Detroit, Kelvin Scholler, is living in Europe, in Germany, in Berlin. And a pianist named Francesco Tristano.
Yes.
No relationship with the Tristano. We toured a little bit in Europe with the Innerzone Orchestra as well.
You recorded something called Outer Zone.
Yeah. Well, that was the takeoff.
Okay.
Because Carl decided to do a tour in the United States. And, of course, the United States is not as acceptable as Europe is.
Mm-hmm.
We were on a bus touring the U.S., and by the time that we got to Mexico, and people started talking about, "Play something with a beat, man," you know, and two-thirds of our audience walked out.
Oh. You know?
By the time that we got to Los Angeles, Carl said, "This is the end of the Innerzone Orchestra." But this Innerzone Orchestra is the same Innerzone Orchestra that we played Montreal as the main act, where Carl asked me, "Do you know any Cubans that would like to do something with us?" I said, "Yeah." So I called Donis, and she brought Oyu Oro to Montreal. I had no idea that we were the main act. But when we got out there, and I'm looking at this ocean of 250,000 people, and they had all of these TV giant screens on the side, so that the people could see, I said, "Whoa, this is amazing." That was actually the last gig on that level. I said, Carl Craig, we got us a thing, man. Let's put this all over the world, man. This is an amazing thing, man, you know. But you know how things go, you know. And,
so the Outer Zone that you recorded?
Okay, the Outer Zone.
Because Marshall Allen was on that one.
Right. One of the Inner Zone was like this. We had an electronic music festival in Detroit, and Carl Craig invited me. He says, do something. I said, well, what about from the Inner Zone to the Outer Zone? I said, okay, you got it. So I did the Outer Zone first gig at the first electronic music festival in Detroit. And then I started planning a recording. So I went ahead and put the first Outer Zone. It features Craig Tavern, and Carl Craig is in there, and two trumpets, because I was thinking Cuban song with two trumpets. That was John Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
And he went ahead and started experimenting with electronic and with his trumpet, you know, that type of thing that Miles used to do with the wah one. And Dwight Adams on the other trumpet, you know, Acunda, Brian Hollis from percussion, and congas and stuff like that, and djembe drum. And we went ahead. My favorite tune from that first Outer Zone is Sunny, which is written for Sunrise.
Yes.
And the beauty of it is because it was never mixed. We never mixed it. And Marshall came over and cut all the things, and then we were doing Sunny, and we ran out of tape.
Oh, wow.
Tape just, boom. You know, the reel just finished there.
Wow.
You know, and then Marshall went back to his hotel because he was playing the Detroit Jazz Festival when we recorded this. And Craig Taylor happened to be on the same festival. That's how I was able to get both of them, you know.
Nice.
And then I went over there, you know what I'm saying, and I gave Marshall a copy of it. And then we ran out of budget because Carl Craig was actually producing the financial aspect for the album. Eventually, he gave me all the rights for the Outer Zone.
Nice.
I kept him in. I brought Carl Craig again to do other things on it. And then he took Craig Tavern, and then they worked together, sort of a funk version of Babaluaye, which we thought it was going to be a real hit on the funk vibe. It's beautiful. But my favorite track is still Sunny. Yeah, because Marshall came over and started playing this blues thing on top of that, and I said, man. How do you know so much about my music?
Because I've got it in front of my face.
Oh.
And I'm going to play as much of it as I can.
I don't want to be self-defeating to my own idea, to my own direction, you know. But I found it inconceivable that there's a CD with Marshall Allen, Craig Tavor, Carl Craig, and that it just goes totally unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
So I went ahead and pulled a second one. On the second one, I got J.D. Allen. It's a double CD. It's amazing. It's like way out there. And I got this lady called Val, you know, the Haitian lady that does electronic.
Oh, yeah, Val Genty.
Yeah, Val, yeah.
Oh, wow.
You know, and there it goes, unnoticed.
Yeah.
I'm going like, wow. Somewhere in between, that's when I want to pull my cord and do the Afro horn. I was already talking to Roman when we recorded the second Outer Zone. He just couldn't make the date.
Before we go, I must ask you about your first release as a leader, Mora. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, my idea was to create what it is now, the AACE label. It was called African America's Creative Experience. And my idea at that time was that all this African presence in the Americas, and African American people had a larger opportunity of being observed in the planet because they came from the United States. And the United States has got this power, you know what I'm saying, of putting, you know what I'm saying, you know, products out there, you know, dominating the market and the world. You know, and the leading music in the planet is really African-American music. It really is.
Right.
You know, it's what sets the pace for everything and everybody.
Right.
So I figured it out that there's got to be some geniuses in the rest of the Americas that, you know, because they don't have this kind of exposure, nobody knows anything about it, and we are losing out on them. So my project was initially, you know, to go into the Americas and find these people, you know, and record them and put them out, you know, do that kind of thing. But of course, you know, you know, it's a great dream, you know, but you need budget, you need people interested, you need money, you need moving here, you need a lot of stuff, you know. And what I ended up doing was record an album that kind of represented the diaspora in the Americas. So I wanted to take a little bit from Brazil, you know, the Afro-Brazilian, a little bit from the Afro-Cuban, Afro-Mexican, African-American, you know what I mean? And bring it all together in one album. It was not a Latin jazz album, like a lot of people reviewed it or something like that. It was just, you know, for a lack of expression, a Pan-African in the Americas intent. Mm. That was, mm-hmm. that's what the idea with Mora was. And, my favorite track in there is Afra June.
Yes.
And I didn't know at that time that Afra June, you know what I'm saying, there is a Elegua. Elegua is Yorisha that opens and closes up the doors,
right.
you know, on the Yoruba thing.
Right.
Well, Babaluaye has an Elegua, which is called Afra.
Oh.
And I didn't know that until much more later.
Mm-hmm.
And when I play that tune, you know, it just falls into that. And when I did my Ocha, you know, my mother, my Ocha is Oshun.
Uh-huh.
But my father
you
is
know
Baba,
I thought so.
But my, fa- but my father is Babaluaye.
Okay.
So then a lot of things made a lot of sense.
Right.
Looking at the perspective of all of that stuff, you know. So, you know, the Afra June actually became sort of a cold tune for WEMU in Ypsilanti, which is, Eastern Michigan University radio station.
Oh, okay.
Because they played it every night at 12 o'clock.
Oh, wow.
Every night. Hmm. For years.
Okay.
It was incredible. Yeah, it was like, whoa, you know. It played every night. That was her name up there. I'll think about her name.
Mm.
The director, the you know, they just you know like a sign off team,
sure.
you know, for the day or something
right.
like that. You know, so just put it on.
Sure.
We just put it and it played. It's 11 minutes. It's long.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a shorter version.
Out.
I'm looking at a 6.5 minute one.
Okay, that happened. Well, in the Mora album, you know what I'm saying, it's 11 minutes.
Right, right.
But then what, are you looking at the CD,
yes.
the Japanese release?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
That's another story. That's another story because there's a later album called, you know, River Drum.
Right, and they
River
added
Drum,
that.
Yeah, in River Drum, you know what I'm saying, I wrote arrangements specifically that came from the ideas of the first Afra June. And this was more orchestrated, you know.
Okay.
And I had from the original people, of course, Kenny Cox mm-hmm. and Rodney Whitaker
mm-hmm.
and some of the fellows in the percussion. But then I brought, for this one, I brought a young, you know, Alex Harding. If you get to look in your tube for Blue People,
you'll see
that band.
Okay.
Sherman Mitchell on trombone and flute,
mm-hmm.
you know, Marcos Belgraves on trumpet.
Yes,
you know, it was a colossal, you know what I'm saying, ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
It was like deluxe, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And
you even had steel drums,
recorded, you know, huh?
You even had steel drums.
And yeah, Emil Bordet on
yes.
drums.
Yes.
You know, who came in from the original percussion choir. You know, and it was part of the idea, you know what I'm saying, of bringing, you know what I'm saying, you know, Pan-African ideas, you know, into the manifestation of this music in a contemporary format, you know. I brought that album to New York and they told me it was too hard. It was too powerful.
Oh, my.
Why don't I take it back and make it... Why don't I go back and record it again and make it more smooth?
Oh, my goodness.
No way, Jose. What are you talking about? Then the music won't have a function. You know what I mean? It will be sleepy. Go to sleep, my brother. Wake up, my brother.
Yeah.
You know, but wake up, people. It's not about go to sleep, people. You
That's
know?
Right.
So, yeah. So, that was the Afra June. So what I did, some years later, the Japanese people chased me around and they wanted to release a Mora album. So I suggested that since we were going to do a lease, I'll never give them up my stuff, but we were going to do a 5-year lease to include, you know what I'm saying, some of the tunes from River Drum.
Got it.
You know, in this Mora CD. And that's how it came out.
Got
now,
it.
The particular version of El Morro there is being choreographed by Eduardo Rivero. From, you know, the Caribbean dance theater, you know, modern dance company in Santiago de Cuba. It's a beautiful work. Yeah, I gave him river drum, not this Mora CD. I gave him river drum. And one day I came to Santiago, and he said, "I have a surprise for you." I said, "Really?" So he took me over to the general rehearsal, and they start playing that stuff. Mm-hmm. Marcos Belgris is playing the trumpet, and there's two couples dancing. It's so erotic. Mm. It's so loving.
Wow.
It's so modern. You know, it's incredible. It's really Black and Caribbean.
All right. Beautiful. You know,
it seduces you. Uh-huh. It's amazing. You know, I said, whoa. I start crying. I said, "Maestro, why do you have to do something like that?" You know, he says, "Well, there's the music. You made me move." So I choreographed it, you know, and I said, it's not just an honor, you know what I'm saying? It's beyond. It's so encouraging. You send me home to write some more music. Mm. You know, hopefully somebody will look after it, you know. And you know, Ronnie Brown, I used one of my from the Mora album. Remember the welcome thing at the beginning? You know,
the prelude. Yes.
He used that for a piece of evidence.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Nice. Yeah. Some kind of a way he looked at it, you know what I'm saying? And he got a whole 11-minute choreography right along with that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I said, yeah. Yeah, I just gave him the three Afro Horn CDs. I said, do what you want, man. Put something out here, man.
Nice. Very nice. Well, yeah. Francis.
So what are we doing with time? It's already 9:50.
So I was just getting ready to say my sign off.
I'm so happy, and I'm really encouraged to talk to you. You know about my music. That's very encouraging to me, especially these days. The Afro Horn really didn't gig this whole year. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
it goes like that, you know.
They're going to make up for it next year because in January you're playing twice. We have you at the Winter Jazz Festival and Arts for Arts.
Returning to the Winter Jazz Fest. Because I'm going to be releasing the third Afro Horn album, At the Edge of the Spiral, the festival. Henry Dumas, "At the Edge of the Spiral, a musician sprouts set cross leg on a blue cloth." If you can imagine him, his soprano sax resting against his inner knee. His Afro Horn linking his ankles like a bridge. The Afro Horn was the newest axe to cut the dead wood of the world. Oh, he's talking music, you know, Henry Dumas. So it's like, phew.
Justice is Compassion. The evolving series from Arts for Art on Thursday, the 19th, and your set is at 9 p.m. Okay, Francisco Mora Catlett, I must stop.
Okay.
I must do my sign off, Francisco Mora Catlett. Thank you so much for sharing time with us.
Anytime. And anytime you wanted to go lecture somewhere about why jazz is African, I'd be ready with my notebook underneath my arm, ready to run.
We'll start with catching you at the Winter Jazz Festival on this summer.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Very happy to be returning to the Winter Jazz Festival.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening was drummer, percussionist, composer, arranger, artistic director of the ensemble Afro Horn, and lecturer, Francisco Mora Catlett. What we're listening to right now is the original version of Afro Jum from Francisco Mora Catlett's debut as a leader, Mora. That's a 1986 AACE release. This is from a 2012 Shout Productions reissue. Before that, we heard Sunny, which was dedicated to Sun Ra, and that is from Francisco Mora Catlett's Outer Zone, a 2007 Premier Crew release. Before that, we heard Doug Carnes Revelation, a version from the Detroit Experiment, from the release The Detroit Experiment. That's a 2002 Rope of Dope Records release. We have Regina Carter on violin, Alan Barnes on flute, Marcus Belgrave on trumpet, Benny Maupin on tenor saxophone, Francisco Mora Catlett on percussion, Jerry Allen on piano, Al Turner on bass, Ron Otis on drums, Amp Fiddler on synthesizers, and Carl Craig, the producer, on on additional synthesizers. Before that, we heard another Carl Craig production, Bug in the Bass Bin, which features Francisco Mora Catlett on percussion. That's from the Inner Zone Orchestra. The name of the release is Programmed, which was released in 1999 on the Astralworks label. Before that, we heard A Quiet Place from Max Roach's To the Max. That's a live performance. The ensemble Mboom. This is a 1991 Blue Moon release. Mboom consists of Eli Fountain, Fred King, Ray Mantilla, Roy Brooks, Joe Chambers, Omar Clay, Francisco Mora Catlett, Max Roach, and Warren Smith. And before that, we heard a conversation between Sun Ra and Henry Dumas. That's from The Ark and the Ankh. This was a conversation that took place in 1966 at Slug Saloon in New York. This is from an IKEF 2001 release. And before that, we had our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next. And we'll be back on January 8th in the new year, and the plan is to feature members of Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra and Jerry Allen. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.